I'd like to thank the crowds for coming to see us. Those who are at Twin. Gentlemen, start your engines. The gentlemen, start your engines, command.
The Drive with Derek Gilbert. Your city, your station, the Eagle 93.9.
Tomorrow night on this program, The Drive brings you Casual Friday. After a week of talking about taxes, government policy, and politics, the heaviest thing I want to talk about tomorrow afternoon is your favorite Christmas television or movie. And possibly the Missouri-Illinois basketball game next week, Tuesday. That's tomorrow night between 5 and 7 on the Eagle 93.9. Now we rejoin our guest, Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Marvin, U.S. Army Special Forces, retired. He's the author of the book Expendable Elite, expendableelite.com. Now, Dan, in the first hour, people listening in might have gotten the impression from our conversation that you were trying to, shall we say, bash the military based on what you saw and experienced in Vietnam back in 1966. Is that true? And
well, let me straighten that out. I love the United States Army, the Marines, the Air Force, the Navy, all of them. I've got a grandson in the United States Air Force right now. I've got a grandson in the 82nd Airborne Division. One of my daughters was in the Navy as an atomic weapons technician. We've got the best soldiers, sailors, Marines, and airmen and Coast Guard people in the world. But we've got some of the most evil leaders, and that's who I'm going after, is those people who would actually put our men in a situation, as General Westmoreland did, where they were fighting the enemy all along the Cambodian border. The enemy could fire into Vietnam and kill our people and wound our people and civilians around them, and we could not, our soldiers could not fire back into Cambodia to kill the enemy. That's the kind of people that I'm going after, not the everyday soldier, sailor, Marine, or airman that's doing the best job in the world for this nation to keep it free.
Now, Dan, why did you call the book Expendable Elite?
That's a good question. The reason it's called that is that we, as Green Berets, and I mean that's a tough bunch of men, were not afraid of any enemy because we figured that they knew enough about us so they'd be afraid of us. Well, the only thing that we feared was our government, and that would be when they declared us to be expendable. So I thought Expendable Elite, and that's the subject, that's the title that my publisher said would be the one to go.
You know, you had an incident, and by the way, I want to remind you at home that you're welcome to call in and question or even challenge Colonel Marvin on what he's written and recorded in his book, Expendable Elite. 874-9390 is the number. Now, Dan, you had an incident you record where you were requested by the CIA to assassinate the Prince of Cambodia. What happened? And how did that result in you basically having a target painted on your back?
Okay, well, that was in June of 1966. The CIA special agent Walter McKim came to my camp with a request that I organize a group of Vietnamese irregulars, to look like and be armed like the Viet Cong and to go into Cambodia on this one day that Prince Sihanouk, the head of Cambodian government, went up north to a temple that was near the South Vietnamese border and north of where we were. We were the closest Green Beret camp to that area. Also, we had a reputation of winning every battle that we had with the enemy. So I said, yes, I'll accept that mission, but with a quid pro quo. I said, the President of the United States has got to tell the American people that there will be no more enemy sanctuaries. There will be no more safe havens for the men who are shooting from the other side of the border onto this side of the border. And I want it to be such that a friend of mine in Fort Bragg, North Carolina, will hear the President give the speech and send me a copy of that page of the New York Times that tells about that speech. Of course, the CIA man would gladly have sent me a copy of the CIA copy of the New York Times that they'd printed themselves. But I wanted a friend of mine in Fort Bragg, North Carolina, tell me that. Well, 2 days before this mission, these 42 men were all volunteers in what we call a suicide mission, were to get ready to go onto a Vietnamese barge that we had apprehended from the enemy and go up into Cambodia to ambush and kill Prince Sihanouk. 2 days before that, Walter McKim came back to my camp. This is all in the book. And when he came up to me in the command bunker, I asked him that what happened to the quid pro quo, that I hadn't heard anything from my friend in Bragg. Was the president going to do as I demanded? And he wouldn't even talk about it. He kept asking me about, you know, were things all set, everybody trained and everything. So I ordered him out of my camp. And Lieutenant Strait was my XO. I ordered John to take him to his little white Whirly Bird, it's an Air America helicopter, and get him out of the camp. And as he was leaving the command bunker and walking across towards the helicopter with Lieutenant Strait, he looked back at me and he says, "Captain, you can't fight the system because you can't win." And about 6 to 10 days after that, and I apologize, Derek, for not looking into my book and getting the exact number of days, I got word from my agents. And all of my agents were females, and we had very good reason for that, which we can get into later. But they reported that there was an ARVN, Army of Vietnam regiment of about 1,200 men with anti-tank weapons. Every big weapon that they had in their inventory were on the way up the Baysack River in Navy landing craft utilities with a specific mission to attack and destroy my camp.
1,200 men against how many under your command?
Well, there was my A-team, Vietnamese A-team, and about 400 South Vietnamese. And the biggest weapon we had was one 50-caliber machine gun.
So how did you avoid getting killed?
Well, as soon as we got word from our agents, we respected our agents to tell us nothing but the truth. Major Foy Van Lee, who was my counterpart, sent an envoy from our camp, I believe it was one of his lieutenants in his special forces team, up the river with a squad of indigenous personnel, my strikers we call them, to protect him. And went right down the Baysack River and over to the Mekong, and there met with the chairman of the Wahao, the Buddhist Wahao Central Committee. This man knew General Quang Van Dang, Lieutenant General Quang Van Dang, who commanded all Vietnamese forces in the 4th Corps, which would have meant he commanded that ARVN regiment that was headed up our way to kill us. He met with General Dang in his office. General Dang had known nothing about this. We learned later that it was something that had been rigged up between the CIA and Premier Key, who was very much pro-CIA. And General Dang immediately got on the telephone, called the president of Vietnam, Premier Ky, and told him he was taking over the situation and he didn't want brothers killing brothers in his corps. He immediately went on across the hall, got a hold of Colonel William O. Desabri, full colonel, United States Army, who was his senior advisor, got in Colonel Desabri's helicopter, flew over that regiment when they were about from between 2 and 10 minutes to hit my camp. And he radioed down to the advisors, the American advisors that were with that regiment, and asked them, "Why are you attacking An Phu?" And they said, "Because there's a renegade captain named Marvin who's leading the Wahaos against Saigon, against the central government," which was a lie. And General Dang immediately ordered the regiment to turn back to their home base, and then he and Colonel Desabri flew into my camp with their armed helicopter escorts, and I called everybody in there in formation, and he gave everybody safety from any possibility of harm from courts or military.
Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Marvin is our guest on the Eagle 93.9. His book is Expendable Elite, the new edition called the Victory Edition. Now, Dan, how did it make you feel realizing that the guys who were supposed to be on your side were coming after you?
Well, you know, at first I felt like I was betrayed. And I didn't remember something that after the trial and after we had victory and I started to write the additional 100 pages that go onto the book, that are in the book, with the publisher, I had it phrased to be to head out with a title, Betrayed. And I sent it to a friend of mine who's an ex-Green Beret, and he called me right away. He says, Dan, you can't do that. And I said, why? He says, you just think back to the 28th day of January of 1984, which was the day before I came to know the Lord Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Take you back to that day, and you would have done the same thing that your men did. And I explain in my book that I'm not mad at a one of them. They were doing what they've been taught to do. They've been intimidated. Lieutenant Strait, as a matter of fact, my exo, the last time I tried to reach him by phone before the trial, his wife answered the phone and said, Dan, I can't let you talk to John or we'll lose our retirement pay.
Really? Now, who was making that threat against Lieutenant Strait?
Well, I would imagine it was probably the CIA through the Special Forces Association. Because that's everybody, every one of my men who were plaintiffs against me had been contacted by, met with, and were supposedly paid all their expenses with the Special Forces Association. But then we found out after the trial and after we got a financial statement from the Special Forces Association for the 4 months of January, February, March, and April, and the trial ended the 27th day of January, not one penny was spent from the Special Forces Association to pay the expenses of the plaintiffs, the witnesses, or the attorneys. And we're talking about a total of about $300,000 in expenses.
Huh.
Of course, we didn't have to pay them because we won. But we assume, and I can't prove it, you can't hardly prove anything with the CIA, but I assume that they did like they did with General Quang Van Dang when I finally got him into this country and I demanded some kind of help, and Tom Polgar helped me on it. He was the last CIA head in all of South Vietnam. He was a station chief for the last 2 years of the war. And he helped me to gain some $20,000 total for General Dang to help him get settled into this country after being his character being assassinated and everything for about 14 years by the CIA. And they gave him that money in four plain envelopes with nothing written on them of $5,000 each of unmarked bills so he could prove nothing about where they came from.
Interesting. So yep. The CIA has a long memory, it appears. They couldn't wipe you out in 1966, so they tried to take you out in court in 2006, 40 years later. Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Marvin, the author of Expendable Elite, is our guest on the Eagle 93.9, and we'd like you as part of the conversation. It's 874-9390 if you want to call in. Area code 573-874-9390 if you're listening in on the internet stream and calling from outside mid-Missouri. Our conversation continues. We want to talk about safe havens and whether our soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan are dealing with them too. This is The Drive on the Eagle 93.9 and the Eagle939.com.
Now from the heart of America, bringing the world to Columbia and Columbia to the world, this is The Drive with Derek Gilbert on your city, your station, the Eagle 93.9.
Boy, that kind of an intro, it's hard to live up to. Tomorrow morning, Tim Murphy will have some expert advice for you. The Expert Minutes with Dr. Charles Mattingly, DDS, tips on how to brighten up your smile just in time for the holidays. And, of course, Shelley Tucker with the latest news and Eagle Eye traffic and weather together every 10 minutes on the 10s. That's tomorrow morning between 5:30 and 8 on the Eagle 93.9. Talking with Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Marvin and his book, Expendable Elite. And, Dan, here we are almost halfway through our time, and we've not yet told people where they can find a copy of your book if they're interested.
Right. The best place to get it, especially if you want a signed copy, is to dial 1-800-556-2012, and that's Trinday Press. Tell them that you'd like to have a signed copy of Expendable Elite. They'll take your credit card number and everything, and then he'll let me know with a copy of the invoice, and then I'll mail it direct from here signed to whatever person you want it signed to, and it's always nice to give me a little bit of background, too. But it's funny. I went to an antique store today, and they had my book on the shelf, and they had it listed as rare. The first edition.
Interesting.
Right.
Of course, this new edition.
We only published so many, and then after the trial, they all sold.
That's right.
That's right.
And the new edition, the Victory Edition, in recognition of that victory in court over the Special Forces Association. Our number, again, 874-9390, if you'd like to call in and ask a question of Colonel Marvin. During a break, a little while back, I won't mention any names, but there was a gentleman who called and questioned or was challenging some of the things that Colonel Marvin was saying. And let it be known that Colonel Marvin is open to talking to anybody, whether you're in agreement or interested in what he's saying, or whether you think that he's perhaps stretching the truth. We'll take your calls at 874-9390. Now, Dan, one of the big problems you faced and your men faced in Vietnam.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, I'd like to mention to anybody who's listening, I'd be glad to have them contact me through the website or on the phone today, on the air. I'd be glad to talk to anybody because I only speak about the truth. It costs $152,000 just to put that truth forward in the court in Charleston, South Carolina. And when we arrived in that courtroom, the Special Forces Association representatives, the attorneys there, were surprised. They didn't think that we'd showed up. We were the very first ones, Chris Milligan, my publisher, and I, to the best of my knowledge, to ever show up in court against the special operations people. They just assumed we'd be scared to death. And like I told one of their attorneys, I said what he forgot was that I was one of them, and I was the biggest, baddest one of them.
Now, Dan, you're in New York, and your publisher is in Oregon. Why did they file this lawsuit in Charleston, South Carolina?
Well, because Colonel Tuttle, who's deceased now, he's dead now, was the lead plaintiff, and he lived there in Charleston, because Charleston was a very much a pro-military town.
Sure.
And
sure,
they thought that they would convince the jury. In fact, one of the attorneys said there's not a member of that jury going to vote for Dan Marvin. They wanted to convince everybody there that I was anti-military. And when I went in there, you could tell I'd been a soldier for 21 years, where the plaintiffs looked like a bunch one of my friends said they looked like a bunch of bums. They didn't have any military bearing whatsoever, where my publisher and I both showed the people in that courtroom, and especially the jury and the judge, that we cared about the United States of America. We cared about our military services, and we were just trying to correct the evil in it.
The big problem that you faced, that our men and women in Vietnam faced in the 1960s, were the safe havens in Cambodia. Are our soldiers today in Iraq and Afghanistan facing anything similar?
Well, I do know this, that General Tommy Franks, at one time in an interview with a cigar aficionado, stated that he was concerned. In fact, I think he mentions it in his book, that he was concerned that we were giving sanctuaries to the enemy in Iraq, similar to the safe havens that we gave the Viet Cong in Vietnam, inside of Cambodia, across the border. Now, if that doesn't tell you that he was concerned, then what else would? We do know for an absolute fact, I have friends who are over there, that they could have weapons and people hidden in mosques and then could attack from those mosques in the middle of the night, and we were not allowed to destroy those mosques simply because they were mosques. That's a safe haven for the enemy at that time, if it was used that way.
Is that a military decision, Dan, or is that a political decision?
I would assume it was political. I mean, it's the same president, the same commander-in-chief, who told the American people on more than one occasion, I heard him myself personally on the radio, tell the American people that the God of Islam was the same as our God. Now, you and I know the difference.
I think any Muslim would say the same thing.
Amen.
They recognize Jesus as a prophet, but not as God in the flesh. There's quite a difference. We're talking
Muhammad is a much better prophet.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
We're talking with Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Marvin. He's the author of a book called Expendable Elite, which is a remarkable document of his time in Vietnam and the experiences that he encountered, and some very disturbing tales as well about the way the military was used there. And we'll talk more in about 5 minutes as we continue about the lessons we can draw from the experience of this A-team captain, former A-team captain in Vietnam, and the way our military is being used today.
Live, local, listening to you. The Drive with Derek Gilbert. Your city, your station. The Eagle 93.9.
Now, you heard about that movie that was out over the summer, Snakes on a Plane. One of the big flaps going on right now in the United States is Shakes on a Plane. The Council on American Islamic Relations trying to pick a legal fight over the case of the imams in Minneapolis who were complaining about the way they were treated on a U.S. air flight. Michael Savage has been following that story, and he will have more to say about that just after 7 o'clock here on the Eagle 93.9. We rejoin Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Marvin, U.S. Army Special Forces retired, Green Beret, captain in Vietnam between late 65 and 1966, and his book Expendable Elite. Dan, when you went to put this book together and assembled the information you'd collected, what kind of help did you get from the former members of your team in Vietnam?
Well, it was really great. It was 1988 when I put together the first draft manuscript. And it took me 4 years to put together all the material, to get the material that I'd sent to my friend in Fort Bragg and to go into some research, too, so I could have proof of what other people said about what happened. And so I sent a copy of that manuscript to those team members who I could locate. And each and every one of those turned out to be a plaintiff at the trial. But anyway, in 1988, Lieutenant Strait and Specialist Sirois sent me a number of tapes, I think five tapes total, that told about what they thought about the manuscript. And they all, in every place in their audio tapes, they said they thought it was, you know, they had no problem with the truth of it. They had things they wanted to add. Lieutenant Strait, believe it or not, added the fact that I had saved his life at Khan Binh during a battle. In the courtroom, he denied that it ever happened. But on that audio tape, and you can tell by the tone and the structure of the audio tape itself, if he was telling the truth. He was trying to help me to have the best possible book. He even tells in that audio tape about remembering the Arvin Regiment coming to attack us. Now, anybody that has any doubt about my veracity, as that one almost caller had, they can go to the website and they can listen to each and every one of those.
So the fellows who recorded audio tapes for you in support of your book were
right.
The guys who went to court 18 years later
right.
to file a suit for libel.
That's right. It's interesting, too, that the Special Forces Association, who organized this entire trial, got the people together, handpicked the attorneys, and developed the whole scenario for it, tried to frighten me with a few letters and calls to my home and that. It threatened my publisher, specifically, in writing, threatened the man who had bought the screenplay rights by telephone to his attorney. But those same men are the ones then that were plaintiffs at the trial, three of them, of the plaintiffs at the trial.
And
they were the ones who we put on the stand, and we played those audio tapes to the jury so they could tell.
Case over at that point, I would think.
Amen.
874-93.
After 9 days of testimony, it only took them 2 hours, which included a lunchtime, to come up with a verdict.
874-9390 is the phone number if you'd like to call in and talk with Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Marvin. Dan, we had a caller who just wanted me to pose a question to you regarding Lieutenant Callie, which was the My Lai incident, was it not? The My Lai massacre?
Right.
Were you familiar with him, or what can you comment on that?
I have no personal knowledge, and I only write or testify to things that I have personal knowledge of.
But you did see that incident from the helicopter at Rock Jaw.
Yes.
Was that, to your understanding, an isolated incident?
No, I don't think so. I think that General Westmoreland's fanatic need for body count to try and prove that he was winning a war that he wasn't is what led a lot of people to kill a lot of innocent people. That's why I would not even allow CIA agent McKim in with his pre-Phoenix program team that he would take into areas such as mine, and he would selectively go through and decide who was pro-communist and who wasn't, and then they would just kill him.
What was the Phoenix program?
The Phoenix program was when it was officially titled. It became the Phoenix program. There's a book by Douglas Valentine called The Phoenix Program, The Phoenix Program, and it basically tells, I think it's between 30 and 40,000 Vietnamese were killed by the CIA agents of, the people that worked with those CIA agents in Vietnam, just under that Phoenix program, 30 to 40,000 people, half of them could have been innocent. I didn't let them into my area. I didn't let anything that I couldn't control in my area. I kept the B-52 bombers out. I kept Agent Orange out. I kept the American reporters out, like I said earlier.
Dan, what lesson do you want people to take from your book as we look ahead at the U.S. military in the 21st century? What changes do you want the government to make in the way it handles and orders about the U.S. military?
Oh, my, glad you asked that question, because I've got a grandson in the 82nd Airborne Division right now. He would love to become a Green Beret, and I told him, please, just wait until this book has had the impact that I want. And right now I'm working with two senators, and I won't name their names right now today, maybe on a future program, and I've asked them to have a hearing in Congress where we could discuss the aiding of the enemy, because I have provided them and I have provided the Judge Advocate General of the United States Army just within the last few months, and bringing it to a point here very about 2 or 3 days ago, to a peak, I have given them evidence which is corroborated by none other than General Westmoreland in writing and Colonel William Tuttle, both of who are dead now, but Colonel Tuttle in a sworn deposition that was read in court in that trial, that proves beyond any doubt that somebody above them ordered the enemy to have sanctuaries and to have the use of the Mekong River.
And again,
that's what I want our people to know. I want them. I want everybody that listens to write their senator, write their congressman, tell them, call Dan Marvin in front of you, and let's get the truth about this stuff.
Hey, Justin, do I remember correctly that incoming Senator Claire McCaskill is on the Armed Services Committee?
Yes, she is.
Okay, so our incoming senator here in Missouri, Claire McCaskill, who was elected over Jim Talent, will be a member of the Armed Services Committee. So maybe
that's
we can...
the ones I'd like him to contact.
Dan, what was your objection to the Vietnam War? Was it with the war itself, or just the fact that our government was playing politics and allowing the enemy sanctuary?
We were not allowed to win the war. You know, in my area, of course, I had an independent operation. And if you read the book, which we proved in court, you can see where everything that was done that way was done to help the Vietnamese people, and then they defended their area. We didn't lose any battles. We had the most secure area in all of Vietnam, but we did it what I feel to be the right way. When you can't let them have sanctuary, you can't let them ship weapons and ammunition up a river that you're protecting so it can get to the enemy. You can't do like President Johnson did and personally order every Air Force target attack in North Vietnam. You've got to give our forces on the ground the right to win. Well, they did not want us to win that war, and that's the biggest problem in a nutshell.
Do you see parallels with the way things are happening in Iraq?
Yes, I do. I mean, when I talked to General Tommy Franks, when he was still in charge of that whole operation over there in his headquarters down in Florida, I called him and I asked him what he felt was the thing that was wrong in the beginning, so to speak. He had to go to a meeting, so he turned me over to this lieutenant colonel. I'll be glad to send you that if I haven't already. Well, it's in my article, Revisit the Past.
Right.
And that colonel told me, point blank, that the thing that bothered the general the most was he only got half the people that he wanted, half the forces, because he wanted to, when he captured a city, he wanted to leave a force there to take care of the people in that city. He couldn't do it. He just had to leave it over to all the rebels and the bad people, the fundamentalists.
You know what's really interesting about that, Dan? Not to interrupt, but there's a story out today, an interview that outgoing Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld gave to Laura Ingraham, talk show host.
Oh,
he says, and this is news as of today. He said that Tommy Franks himself said that he could do it with less than 200,000 men, and that Rumsfeld said he was prepared to send between 300,000 and 500,000.
They are both lying. That's all I got to say. Because if Rumsfeld wanted to send 400,000, he would have ordered Franks to take the number of men that he stated and leave them in reserve if he didn't need them right at the start. I mean, it's one of the things of real advantages to me of having an independent operation. I had to make all those calls myself, only on a much smaller area, of course, than a nation. But General Franks, even though his man told me that and told me that General Rumsfeld, I mean Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, didn't have anybody on his advisory staff, to the best of their knowledge, that had any combat experience. I mean, he refutes that in the book that he wrote after retired and after he got the job of starting the new Army Museum. I don't know what salary he got for that. But he, just like Lieutenant Strait and Sergeant Taylor and all those people that were plaintiffs against me in court and who I proved to be wrong by proving myself to be right and Chris Milligan to be right, those people are the same kind of having the same kind of problem in dealing with the truth, that they don't want to tell on themselves and on their leaders.
Very diplomatically put. Our guest is Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Marvin. His book is Expendable Elite. Visit the website expendableelite.com. Final segment coming up. If you'd like to weigh in, pro, con, or just to ask a question, 874-9390, area code 573-874-9390 if you're calling outside mid-Missouri. I'm Derek Gilbert. This is The Drive on the Eagle 93.9 and the Eagle939.com.
The Drive with Derek Gilbert, your city, your station, the Eagle 93.9.
Our guest, Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Marvin, author of Expendable Elite, his website, expendableelite.com. And Dan, let's remind people one more time where they can get a copy of the book, especially if they'd like a signed copy.
Right. They should call 1-800-556-2012 and ask for a signed copy, and they can take their credit card right then and there. That's the publisher's office. And then he'll notify me with a copy of the invoice. And really, I like whoever is buying it to tell me not only whose name they want it made out to, but just a bit of biography on them so I can say something special.
Now, Dan, you were featured in a special on the History Channel some time back, The Men Who Killed Kennedy.
Right.
And you talked about the fact that you were approached by the CIA, or apparently, to assassinate somebody who was connected to the John F. Kennedy case.
Right. It was on the first week of August of 1965. I was called to Colonel C.W. Patton, P-A-T-T-E-N. He was the group commander of the 6th Special Forces at Fort Bragg. He called me into his office and told me to go down and meet a company man under the pine trees, which would be away from any buildings or people hearing. And he had called another officer up and told him to do the same thing, and we walked down together towards the pine trees, and then we got to about 40 feet from the agent. I went ahead and left him standing there because you don't want two people knowing any one thing. And when I came up to the CIA agent, he showed me identification. I don't remember what his name was. It was probably a name was. It was probably a fake one anyway. And he asked me if I would take the mission of assassinating an American that was about to give secrets to the enemy. And I said, certainly. I said, I don't want anybody giving secrets to the enemy. Of course, what I didn't know at the time was the secrets were the actual proof, the actual photos of the John F. Kennedy autopsy at Bethesda Naval Hospital.
Huh.
And this gentleman, Lieutenant Commander William Bruce Pitzer, P-I-T-Z-E-R, who I was asked to kill, was the man who took those pictures by remote control. And I asked him where the man was. I assumed that whoever it was I was being asked to kill was overseas, because the way it worked, they used Green Berets overseas. They used Mafia in the United States. I was already on orders to report to 5th Special Forces Group headquarters in Vietnam. So I assumed I'd go there, I'd do the job, get dropped from the rolls while I do the job, get back, be picked up again, and nobody even know I was gone back home. And I said, look, I said, I can't accept this job. I said, I got a wife and three children here at Fort Bragg. If all of a sudden I disappear today to do this job for you, they won't even know where I'm gone, or, you know, they'll be worried sick. And so I refused the job. And I don't know who took the job, but I know that the next year he was killed in his office. And I believe at the time he was killed, and there's a book out about it, Without Smoking Gun, Without Smoking Gun by Kent Heiner. I assume that he was going up into his overhead to get those pictures. He was about to retire, and he'd been offered a job, same kind of job you got, only on television. Mm-hmm. And he was going to then release the information about those movies and photographs of the John F. Kennedy autopsy to the public when he was retired. He knew he couldn't dare do it while he was still on active duty, because he'd be in Leavenworth prison very shortly, and they wouldn't even let him tell the public about it. So anyway, that's what I think happened. I found out about it later, what really happened, when I saw a special about the Kennedy assassination. It happened to name him as one of the 42 men that were somehow tied in with the assassination, the autopsy, or the cover-up, and that was his name. So I found, through the help of a friend of mine, found his widow, and I talked to her twice. I taped both conversations. Those tapes have been given to a lot of different people, and they'll be part of some of the information on there will be part of a documentary coming out this fall. And basically, she tells me on that on those audio tapes that she was ordered by Navy officers not to ever discuss her husband's death with anybody.
Hmm. Dan,
and
you
she
gotta,
was never given an autopsy, a complete autopsy, until I arranged it.
You have led a much more interesting life than I hope to lead for the rest of my time on this earth.
Wife wishes I hadn't.
I can only imagine, and thank her for us that she allowed you this time to talk with us on the air this afternoon. Again, Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Marvin, the book Expendable Elite, expendableelite.com. And Dan, we just pray for your safety and for the safety of your grandson still serving in the military. And we thank you for your service and for the service of your grandsons. And for your daughter as well.
I thank the Lord for you and your station and the people that are listening. And I pray that as many as possible have the courage, and they can check this whole thing out either at the court in Charleston or on the website, that they have the courage to write their senators and their congressmen and tell them, look, let's get the truth. This affects every single man and woman that's presently in the armed forces. Are we giving the enemy sanctuary? And it's been proven in my book in court. God bless you all.
Dan, thanks for your time again. Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Marvin, Dangerous Dan, former Green Beret, U.S. Army Special Forces retired, the book Expendable Elite. Tomorrow, Casual Friday on The Drive. We've tackled some heavy issues this week, and so tomorrow we're going to lighten up. We're getting close to the holidays, and we'll talk about appropriate topics for that. I'm Derek Gilbert, Michael Savage and the Savage Nation, next on the Eagle 93.9 and the Eagle 939.com.